This is Your Life is Their Toy, Merchants in Medicine, by Dr. Emmanuel Josephson, from 1948. This is Part 18, The Suppression of Research and Discovery. Now, research committees, which are generally dominated by the AMA and the social service rackets, are extremely effective devices for the suppression or theft of ideas and discoveries. They usurp and monopolize research funds from all sources, research facilities, laboratories, hospitals, clinics, and publication media. They also engineer censorship of the press in their respective fields, force their acceptance as ultimate authorities, set themselves up as dictators of quote-unquote accepted practice, which has the cogent force of legal status, and advertise and publicize themselves and their practices. They are the grand inquisitors of medical science. They are in excellent position to protect their commercial interests and to destroy, quote-unquote, interloping medical discoverers who might arise to offer challenge to their assumed omniscience and authority. The members of the committees generally earn large incomes by doing the scientific chores of allied commercial interests. The committees are ideally adapted to protect the established medico-political order and to bar any threat of upset by independent medical discoverers. By virtue of their position as quote-unquote authorities, the public and the press accept their verdicts. They can affirm or discredit any new discoveries, and from their verdict there is no recourse. They may suppress the announcement of discoveries and subsequently steal them and publish them in the name of the committee or of its members. A case of this type already has been cited. Few physicians would dare challenge such thefts, even though they might be subject to proof. This is the significance of Dr. McCallum's statement on the subject that is quoted by Dr. Heiser. Quote, he said that it had struck him while going through medical literature how sad it was that one never heard of the people who did the real work of research and discovery on many diseases, unquote. This has been brought about deliberately by medical merchants and their organizations. Little hesitancy is shown by these groups, often in the use of the foulest tactics for destroying discoverers and discoveries which threaten injury to their interests or purses. Libel and slander are systematically used in these campaigns of vilification. They are waged by word of mouth, by telephone, by radio, in interviews, and by syndicated columns in the medical, scientific, and lay press. Examples of such committees are as numerous as are the special phases of medicine. The American Otologic Society, for instance, monopolizes the funds and facilities for research in deafness. The millions of dollars which it has collected from the public have been frittered away in building up a political machine in the specialty, in drawing up a worthless and politically censored bibliography of deafness, and in commercial exploitation of deafness. But nothing has been done for the relief of the deaf. Quote-unquote committee research in otology. In the field of otology and of the ear, quote-unquote committee research is an old and well-established practice. How such research operates is illustrated by the manner in which the quote-unquote accepted views regarding the transmission of sound into the ear were established. For over a half century, an active scientific controversy raged between two schools of thought and groups of scientists. One group was led by Professor Helmholtz and Professor Politzer, the former the most eminent physicist of his day, and the latter father of modern autology. This group believed and attempted to prove by experiments, now realized to be crude in the extreme, that sound is transmitted to the inner ear by the tiny bones of the ear only. This view is obviously wrong, because sound is transmitted to the ear even when the bones are destroyed or missing. The other group, with less distinguished leaders, adduced considerable proof that sound was transmitted to the ear through other channels. The controversy had become quite acrimonious. Scientific evidence proved neither view conclusively to the satisfaction of the other group, however obvious the case might be that the ossicles were not essential for transmission of sound into the ear. Professor Politzer and a committee of his supporters decided to force the issue at a Congress of Autologists in Berlin in the early 1890s. They made the theory a political issue and put it to a vote. Professor Politzer and the committee won because of their political influence and the support of Helmholtz. Until the present day, every textbook carries the false statement that the tiny bones of the middle ear are essential for the transmission of sound to the inner ear and for hearing, in spite of the fact that millions of humans who hear without those bones prove the contrary. Few ear specialists or scientists engaged in the study of the ear dare question this dogma or gospel of autology. Those who do are rapidly squelched. American Autologic Society. The same spirit prevails today in the American Autologic Society. The society has raised funds by public subscription for autologic research, but operates as a private and exclusive club for a clique of autologic bosses. It serves primarily to aggrandize them and to boost their business. Thus, when it began its campaign to raise funds, Dr. Arthur Duell, boss of the society, announced in a publicity release in the New York World on June 9, 1929, that he was, quote, considered the greatest ear specialist in the world, unquote. Though the society itself has done little to further the knowledge of deafness, it does attempt to suppress discovery and maintain dogma dictated by it. This is illustrated by an experience of mine. In 1934, I reported in Science an interesting improvement in hearing observed in a series of cases of progressive deafness in which air had been injected into the spine for purposes of diagnosis. I offered the hypothesis that possibly these cases presented adhesions of the meningeal membranes and localized accumulations of fluid in the brain cisterns, which exerted pressure on the auditory nerve tracts, and that these were released by the air pressure. Shortly after this publication, I received the following note from Dr. Edmund Prince Fowler, officer of the American Autological Society, chief in autology at the Manhattan Eye and Ear Hospital, and consultant in autology to the American Telephone and Telegraph Company. Dear Mr. Josephson, I saw a quotation from Science about autosclerosis from meningeal adhesions, cysts, etc. I have autopsy slides of many cases of atherosclerosis, and no indications such as you mention. It might be well to write science correcting the impression made by the quotation in question. Edmund Prince Fowler. Assumption of omniscience. This letter demonstrates the spirit of authoritarianism and the assumption of omniscience, which is as usual as it is unwarranted. It would be absurd to expect that microscopic slides would show up massive accumulations of fluid in the meningeal cisterns, which are destroyed in the process of securing the pathological specimens. I replied as follows. Dear Mr. Fowler, I am a bit puzzled by your discussion of the news reports of my preliminary note published in a recent issue of Science. You state that on the basis of your autopsy slides, you have failed to note any cases of meningeal adhesions and cysts in atherosclerosis, and consequently doubt my findings in progressive deafness and so-called atherosclerosis, as you put it. It is an interesting fact that a number of the cases which constituted the basis of this study were diagnosed as atherosclerosis by eminent colleagues and given a hopeless prognosis. If my memory serves me correctly, one of them was a case which you yourself so diagnosed and prognosed. If your statement is to be interpreted to mean that meningeal adhesions do not occur in deafness because you have not found them in atherosclerosis, it contradicts the fact that we all know that deafness occurs in meningitis, and that meningeal adhesions are often found in meningitis. If your statement is to be interpreted as signifying that no adhesions were found in cases which you diagnosed as atherosclerosis and autopsied, it is a bit more understandable. What puzzles me is what criteria of diagnosis you use clinically to differentiate the cases of progressive deafness which on autopsy you found presented the pathological picture for which alone I am inclined to reserve the diagnosis atherosclerosis. Also, I am puzzled to understand how you explain away the finding of atherosclerosis in cases which present no deafness. Possibly presentation of the data before one of our specialty organizations would be in order. But unfortunately, those organizations are such rackets and monopolies that it is generally impossible for those not in the inner ring to get an opportunity to present significant discoveries. Signed, E.M. Josephson. Confirmation of the validity of my hypothesis has been offered by the discovery of similar conditions about the optic nerve causing cases of blindness that recover vision on release of the adhesions and reestablishment of free flow of fluid. The American Otological Society does not encourage research work except in directions outlined by the committees of the society for which the membership can claim full credit. All other work is disregarded or discredited when possible in the interest of preserving the prestige of the members of the society. The research fund has done much, however, to create hereditary dynasties in otology and to subsidize the advancement of sons of the society's bosses, but it has materially retarded the advance of otology. The only product of this so-called ontological research has been the brutal exploitation of the deaf by the Lempert fenestration. Parentheses. Quotations. Window, in parentheses. Operation. These operations have lined the purses of the ringleaders of autology, and the brutal malpractice has completely deafened and maimed a multitude of victims. The story of this operation and its exploitation is told in the appendix at the end of this volume. The same is true of the National Cancer Committee and its subsidiaries. They have engineered, with the aid of the American Science Writers Association, the official sanction and support of their activities by having Congress establish the National Advisory Cancer Council and the National Cancer Institute under their control. Further experiences in medical research. I can most clearly illustrate the activities of the Research Committee, or CLICS, and the perfection of organization introduced by Simmons and his successor by citing my own experiences. These have taught me that the CLICS cannot think of medicine except in terms of personal profit. Also, that the more closely the individual, quote-unquote, leader is identified with social service activities, the more mercenary are his motives. For medical research and discovery, I found that I had a natural aptitude. As a result, in a career of over 2 decades, I have made 118 discoveries. The first, made while I was still a student, was a simple and obvious method of diagnosing malignancy of cancer from tissue sections. It was published in the Medical Record in 1917. Credit and acclaim for this discovery has gone to one of the shining lights of a committee on cancer. This initial work was followed by publication of an accidentally discovered method of causing a flare-up of latent leprosy that enabled its recognition. There then followed in rapid succession a series of discoveries in connection with the eyes, ears, nose, and throat. These researches were done at my own expense and were published in medical journals in all parts of the world, including the journals published by the American Medical Association, of which I had become a member. The discoveries gained for me recognition as a scientist and fellowship in national specialty and scientific societies. My work was listed in the 5th edition of the American Men of Science. A crusader resigns from the AMA. During my membership in the American Medical Association, I consistently attacked corrupt medical politics. I became one of the original advocates of the idea of group medical care at a fixed annual fee and organized a sizable group of physicians for that purpose. My articles on the topic of medical organization were widely published, many in the columns of the Medical Week, the official magazine of the New York County Medical Society. In an article in Liberty Magazine of April 5, 1930, entitled Doctors and Their Ethics, Grace Robinson quoted extensively from my articles that had been published in medical channels on the subject of medical corruption. This brought down on me an editorial attack by Fishbein in the Journal of the American Medical Association, which libelously asserted that I was, quote, the would-be leader of the Bolshevik movement in American medicine, unquote. In 1931, I vigorously attacked the sale of the worthless and dangerous infantile paralysis quote-unquote convalescent serum and compelled its abandonment after it had caused many deaths. Indignant at the failure of the association to act to protect the public from it, I resigned in December 1931. Ostracism, libel, and suppression follow. Shortly after my resignation, the publications controlled by the AMA and its subsidiaries were closed to me. My letters on medical politics were flatly rejected by the editor of the Medical Week, the local county medical publication. I and my scientific work were calumnied and slandered, both to the profession and to the public. No effort was spared to damage my professional and scientific reputation. This has resulted, unfortunately, in more serious injury to the public than to myself, as I will make clear. In 1933, I brought to light the widespread prevalence of impairment of vision due to malnutrition, especially to deficiency of vitamin A. This condition was then supposed to be non-existent in the United States. My report, entitled Effects of Depression on the Vision of Children, was the first intimation of its prevalence published in this country. It would have been possible for me to secure aid for these children in the form of an adequate diet if the representatives of the New York Academy of Medicine and of social service agencies engaged in eye work, Doctors Conrad Behrens, Legrand, Hardy, and Daniel Kirby, had not withheld their confirmation and approval. 3 years later, my findings had been repeatedly confirmed. The damage had been done and the situation had greatly improved thanks to rising employment. Only then did the social service clique first voice cognizance of the problems of nutrition that had become a mere academic question. At this time, there appeared the textbook Diseases of the Eye, edited by Conrad Behrens and written by, quote, 82 international authorities, unquote. In this book, a few lines sufficed to relate all that these, quote unquote, authorities had to tell about the already large science of the influence of diet on the eyes and vision. Glaucoma becomes a political football. At about that time, I discovered the cause and remedy of primary glaucoma, one of the most frequent causes of hopeless blinding of adults. The method of treatment is medical with cortin, the hormone of the adrenal cortex gland. It eliminates largely the blinding glaucoma operations, from which many of the leaders of ophthalmology derive a large part of their incomes. They therefore undertook to suppress my sight-saving discovery. An article on the glaucoma discovery submitted to the Journal of the AMA was rejected. When I published an announcement of the discovery in the magazine Science, it was widely publicized in the daily press throughout the country and came to the attention of thousands of sufferers who might have benefited from the treatment. They rushed to their physicians, who knew nothing about it because it had been suppressed in their medical journals. To protect their reputations, they condemned as worthless the method concerning which they knew absolutely nothing. In their denials was mixed the element of revenge for the humiliation which they suffered due to their ignorance of the method. That was the result of suppression of publication of my work in medical channels. Illustrative of the profound ignorance of a supposed authority on the subject was a letter written by Professor H. Maxwell Langdon, professor of ophthalmology at the Graduate School of Medicine of the University of Pennsylvania. He protested in the letter column of Time magazine of July 12, 1935, that, quote, "the effect of Cortin, as distinguished from adrenaline, is not yet known," unquote. Though it had been common knowledge for almost a decade that their actions and properties are entirely different. On such false ground, he protested the publication of the discovery. The AMA machinery for discrediting medical discoveries that damage the purses of its overlords and elude its press censorship promptly went into operation. In a syndicated column that he wrote for the NEA and the Scripps Howard newspapers, Dr. Morris Fishbein attacked my glaucoma discovery and alleged that, quote, "the observer in question had little real evidence to support his contention, and no one has been able to confirm his views," unquote. This statement of Fishbein's was as devoid of truth as are many of his other, quote-unquote, authoritative comments. There appeared shortly thereafter my book entitled Glaucoma and Its Medical Treatment with Cortin, which was based on the successful treatment of several hundred cases of glaucoma, the largest number ever covered by a single report up to that time. Also, a brilliant confirmation of my work had been published by a prominent Western ophthalmologist in the California and Western Medical Journal. It brought down on him a warning to refrain from further confirmation of the discovery. And that concludes part 18 of Your Life is Their Toy, Merchants in Medicine, by Dr. Emmanuel Josephson from 1948.